trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. And it's cooler than it was last week.
It's cooler than it should be. How's that? We've been running rather...
It's cooler than it usually is.
Yes, we have been below average now. I just went back below average temperatures, either a couple of degrees or several degrees, or in one case, almost 15 degrees below average since June 18th, according to what I'm seeing here. At this time of year, we typically would be running about July 1, would typically be a high temperature of 92 degrees. Today's high temperature is expected to be 86 degrees. Tonight, by the way, today is July 1, 2026 for broadcast on July 2, 2026. And the high temperature on the day of the broadcast will only be 83 degrees. Again, our typical high right now will be about 92. Thursday night will be 53. Friday will be 87. We're not getting complaints about this. 5 to 10 degrees below average is just fine with people in the Sacramento Valley in general. Friday night will be 56 degrees, which is about average. July 4th, Independence Day, will be 89 degrees and sunny. Saturday night will be 55 degrees and mostly clear. Sunday will be 86 degrees. Monday will be 83 degrees. And Tuesday will be 86 degrees. Looking forward, is there any time in the next week or so when it's going to get really hot? Well, according to the National Weather Service, no. That's the easy answer. Triple-digit highs are in the forecast for the northern Sacramento Valley on the 4th of July. Redding, Red Bluff.
That's up in, that's in the places where they don't get any ocean breezes at all.
And we've been getting that very strongly. What we're really seeing here is a lot of delta breeze, a lot of coastal influence over the last couple of weeks coming in pretty strongly every evening. Nights are cool. Plants are really thriving on this. Young seedlings I've been planting out are taking without even showing any stress whatsoever. So that's been great. Recent cooler temperatures will continue for us here in this part of the Sacramento Valley. So you've got great planting weather right on through the 4th of July weekend. What do you mean great planting weather? It's July. You can't plant anything in July.
You can plant.
Have you got your okra in yet? Have you got your okra planted? Well, you can plant that in July. You can plant basil in July. I wonder if there's any recipes that use okra and basil. You can still plant, you know, tomatoes if you haven't gotten them in. But if I were doing it now, I would focus on cherry tomatoes, sauce tomatoes, or smaller size ones like Early Girl rather than big salad or slicing type tomatoes. Peppers can continue to plant right on through the summer. Several years ago, we just began shifting smaller pepper plants up into bigger pots because we had people wanting them. We'll sell them all the way into September and they'll have plenty of fruit on them. They will develop and they will ripen properly in this climate, even planted that late. But the two that I would focus on, if you're a late starting vegetable gardener, cucumbers and squash from seed, even, or young seedlings, healthy seedlings, not overgrown seedlings, will produce in 3 to 4 weeks. So getting those in the ground, getting them established in this nice weather will also give you continued production all the way into October, even November sometimes in this area, September, October for sure. So you can still plant a lot of those things.
What about flowers? I mean, you're talking all vegetables now. Yeah. What if we want some nice flowers?
Zinnias love this. Zinnias and cosmos go in beautifully now. Dahlias can still be planted, mostly bedding plant type dahlias, the ones that are coming in bloom in smaller pots. They'll continue to bloom right through the summer. I always like to do a July or early August planting of the large flowered marigolds because those will give me blooms in October, which is the time that we typically want those. So lots of flowers can go in now. And of course, the regular things like petunias and impatiens, you know, we're all begonias can all be planted fine right on through the summer. Something that's looking really nice for the shade right now, caladiums. We don't even get them into our nursery until May. We pot them up in May or June and they start pushing up right away and they give you those big, bright, colorful leaves for shade gardens right on through about September, October. In this area, they generally go very nicely till about the middle of October. Nights finally start to drop below the mid-50s. Caladiums are true tropical plants. Anything below about 55 triggers them to go into, it's not even a dormancy, just a shutdown mode. At that point, if you wish to dig them up and store them, you can do that. You only paid a couple of dollars for the plant, so probably simplest for you just to buy a new one next year. But they will give lots of color all through the warm part of the season. They love our summer here. They love our high temperatures in the summer. They just don't want full sun. But caladium is a great colorful thing to plant in the shade garden here in the Sacramento Valley. The most common question we get about caladiums nowadays is this a good house plant?
Yeah, that was my question, Don.
The answer is no. In my opinion, it's not a good house plant. Because it'll get spider mites, I guarantee, and your light is probably not bright enough for it. Even though it's a shade plant, your indoor light is probably not bright enough for it. Having said that, give it a try. Don't hesitate to wash it off every 5, 6, 7 days to minimize the likelihood of spider bites. You can certainly attempt it as a houseplant. Alocasias, colocasias have become popular houseplants. They also get spider mites. So I'm not a big fan of them as indoor plants. They just chronically get them, but you can try it. The thing is that the light status is probably not high enough. If that doesn't work, hey, put it outside in a pot on the porch. They're great in containers. They're great in the ground. Just don't put it in hot afternoon sun. Caladiums are something not widely grown in the West, really popular in the southeastern United States for mass planting. Our growers are all out of Florida.
And in Canada in the winter.
In the winter?
Don't you remember the picture that Henry sent us of his caladium collection sitting there on the bench?
Calatheas. Calatheas and caladiums are two different things.
So I was getting the wrong thing.
Okay, yeah. So calathea, good point, because a lot of people make this confusion. Calatheas, or calatheas, as I learned it, C-A-L-A-T-H-E-A. And I learned it calathea, but I've almost always heard calathea, the way you said it. It's in the prayer plant group. It's a Maranta relative. And that's a good indoor plant. I've done very well with them, except for their tendency to just abruptly die after a year or two. Other than that, they're great. They need pretty bright light. They're pretty easy to care for. Totally different beast. Caladiums are in the calla lily family. Yet another houseplant relative or outdoor shade plant relative that's in the calla lily group, and which includes all of your golden pothos, all your philodendrons, alocasias, colocasias, caladiums are all in that same family. We just don't generally treat caladiums as houseplants. We treat them as outdoor summer annuals. You could try them indoors, as I say. Generally speaking, I don't think they're going to be super successful. So. Caladiums are something you can plant right now. Lots of things you can plant right now. Weather is great for it. 55 to 85 degrees is absolutely perfect planting weather. We're going to only be slightly above that for the next week or so. Try to get things in. Hand water, check daily, water as needed. I think you'll be very pleasantly surprised by how quickly things will establish in this weather. KDRT is community radio. That means we're public radio. So we rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. Thanks to those of you who do contribute. If you wish to, just head on over to KDRT.org and click on the support button. We always get great announcements from folks and events, and the Master Gardeners here in Yolo County are very active during the summer. So you've got in front of you a couple of online events, if I recall.
Hi. The first one I want to tell you about is July 4th. I know that's fast, but this is a Zoom meeting, meaning that people can interact with each other. And it's called Kitchen Garden Chat, the best way to store the garden bounty.
Yeah.
And these kitchen garden chats are meetings, not webinars, meaning that the audience can interact with them. So this is going to be a wonderful thing, and it is on Zoom. And they have the link for you to get in there and register.
July 4th, 10 a.m. to 11 a.m., Kitchen Garden Chat. Best way to store the garden bounty.
So on July 9th, from 3 to 4 p.m., this is going to be a webinar. This is the new Arboretum All-Stars and Climate Ready Plants. So again, a lovely thing. Once it's over, you will be able to go and look at the recording of it. The next one is on July 10th. We're giving you these just so you have a chance to, you know, do something with them. Plan ahead. July 10th, 1:30 a.m. to 2:30 a.m.
How about p.m.?
I think there's something wrong with this notice.
We'll go with p.m.
We'll go with p.m., yeah. And this one's in person. It's at the Woodland Community and Senior Center, which is 2001 East Street in Woodland, and it's a workshop. So you can sign up by calling the center, and they give the phone number there, I'll just give it. What the heck? 530-661-2001.
All right, we got all kinds of topics here today. What do you have in front of you?
Well, I've actually got a message from Benjamin, who is one of our longtime listeners, who writes to us with some of the most amazing questions. Thank you, Benjamin, for all of your contributions. Mm-hmm. So Ben says, in case you have time in future episodes, I would love to learn more about potting soil mixes generally and blueberry soil specifically. So do you want me to go through the whole thing, or do you want to just...
I'll split this in two. First part of the question was how to formulate a potting soil. And we talked briefly about that in a previous show. And we will talk more about that. What we use at our nursery, for example, what are the components, whether you can source them locally, which could be a challenge for some things, and what you're really aiming for with a potting soil. That's a pretty long conversation. I do want to go into that because I have more and more customers trying to grow not just food plants, but all kinds of things in containers. Every now and then they'll walk in and you don't want to disappoint them, but they're holding a 5 gallon container and an indeterminate tomato, and they want to know what kind of potting soil to use. And you want to say, this isn't going to work, is what you really want to say. But what you do,
the pot isn't 4 feet deep.
The pot isn't big enough. That's correct. So as far as that goes, I can tell you from considerable testing on your behalf, folks, a 15 gallon container is the absolute minimum size I would use for much of anything at this point, because it holds 1.5 cubic feet of soil. That's enough for a determinate or an indeterminate tomato. That's enough for one or two peppers. It's enough for a great big plant of basil. You need an adequate soil volume here in the Sacramento Valley and in climates like ours, such as interior Southern California. So right in there, your container size is going to be the most important decision you're going to make. Then what you fill it with is the second most important decision you're going to make. So we'll come back to that, because that is a whole segment, and I really would like to get into that. I want people to grow things in containers if they don't have the option of putting them in the ground. And it's frustrating when people just don't start with a big enough container, or when the horticulture industry says to you, here's a hanging thing, we'll call it topsy-turvy, put a tomato in it and grow it for the season, and show you this artificially contrived photograph of a tomato with 40 fruit on it hanging in something that only holds 0.5 cubic foot of soil. Ain't going to happen here. There may be climates where that works, but it isn't this area. But the other question he asked was about impulsively purchasing some blueberries.
Let me read that paragraph.
I'm very familiar with this phenomenon.
I bought 3 sunshine blueberry plants out of an exuberance of enthusiasm.
Yes.
Over exuberance of enthusiasm. Yeah. They say don't shop for food on an empty stomach, but the same is true for buying fruit trees and bushes. Mm-hmm. I'm in Southern California in the San Fernando Valley with alkaline soil, alkaline water, low humidity, and semi-arid conditions. So my expectations for success are low. I think I'm gravitating towards making raised beds with an azalea soil mix and perhaps adding some sulfur. Do you think that would give them a chance? I'll need a lot. Could I make a substitute mix on my own? And that gets back to the one we're going to talk about next week.
Well, first of all, the blueberry variety that you chose is a really good one, so for your purposes especially, but for other listeners in Southern California and pretty much anywhere in California, Sunshine Blue has proven to be one of the most adaptable of the Southern High Bush hybrid blueberries that's come on the market in the last 20 or 30 years. It will produce in areas with as little as 100 or less chilling hours. It does not require the chilling hours that the traditional northern blueberries required, which was often 800 to 1,000 chilling hours. The San Fernando Valley, you might get a few hundred. I don't know exactly what your chilling hours are, but Sunshine Blue, they're growing them in San Diego. They're growing them all over California. It's a very good quality berry. I've grown it. They're good size. It produces for about a 3 to 4 week period. I've been very happy with Sunshine Blue. Only mistake I would say that you made was buying 3 of the same variety. Blueberries don't require cross-pollination. You'll get plenty of fruit from these 3, but you would get bigger fruit if you had another variety. So I would suggest you take your exuberance and go pick up a 4th blueberry bush of some
maybe
other.
Maybe you can trade with somebody.
Yeah.
To buy blueberries.
Yeah, talk to your neighbor and see if they'd like to arrange something here. But I would just throw in another one of the Southern High Bush in there. There's a bunch of different ones. Misty's a good one. I have if you go to redwoodbarn.com, I have information there about the different blueberry varieties. Southern high bush blueberries are very tolerant of low chilling and reasonably tolerant of conditions that we never thought would be suitable for blueberries. 40 years ago, when we opened blueberries, there weren't that many varieties. All these new hybrids had yet to come on the market. We had very high pH and very high salt content in our water. We were on a different source of groundwater in those days, and it was all groundwater. Now we're mostly on surface water in our area. So we would just tell people, you can't grow them here. It just doesn't work. Nobody was succeeding with blueberries. These new ones came on the market. We changed our water supply, went to surface water. Mostly we still have well water. It's a slightly deeper, well, somewhat significantly deeper source of groundwater. But generally speaking, the pH of our water in the Davis area is still alkaline somewhat. And there are periods when we have more salts in the water. So you wouldn't think it would be optimal for these. But we've learned a couple other things about blueberries, especially these new hybrids. It isn't the exact pH that matters. In fact, it's almost never the exact pH that matters for any plant. So they'll tell you to try and get the pH down to 5.5 or something. The pH of our soil here is around 7. The pH of our water is closer to 8. Very hard to bring the pH down permanently. In fact, you can't. You can continue to adjust it with things like soil sulfur, but it's very difficult to bring it down permanently. But what we really learned is that blueberries are never drought tolerant. This is crucial. They need real even moisture. Mulching can make a huge difference in the success of your blueberries, almost more than anything else, because it evens out watering problems. They're also very sensitive to fertilizers. So high salt content fertilizers or synthetic fertilizers of any kind tend to cause leaf burn. And that was a big problem because most of the fertilizers that we were all selling 40 years ago, 30 years ago, were conventional fertilizers. Even those labeled for azaleas, camellias, blueberries, if they had any nitrate in them or were ammonia-based, they were going to burn the leaves of the blueberries. They're just particularly sensitive to conventional synthetic fertilizers. So if you use organic fertilizers for them, or particularly use mulches and organic soil amendment that contains some organic fertilizers, you'll generally get better results. I watered mine with a micro spray system because that provides the water more evenly than a drip system. And when I've had them, I run it a couple of times a week and I water very, very thoroughly. And if there's a dry wind picking up here, just like your Santa Ana winds in Southern California, I'll turn it on that morning just to moisten the whole zone, even if the plant didn't really need irrigation, because I know low humidity is not something that they like particularly. So that right there is the starting point. Mulch, organic material, organic sources of nitrogen, plenty of moisture. Those are the key steps with a blueberry, and a big enough container to hold that whole soil volume, you know, what's necessary to keep a blueberry bush alive. Blueberry bush is about like a rose bush. A half wine barrel per plant would be ideal. So that holds 3+ cubic feet of soil. I've also used livestock troughs, the kind that are 2 feet deep, 2 feet wide, and 6 feet long. It takes a lot of soil to fill that. I put 3 blueberry plants in one of those, got more blueberries than we knew what to do with. There was a micro spray system on that I would turn on to water them most of the time, but this is important. About every couple of weeks, I'd take a hose and set it on there to let it really soak through until water was flowing out the bottom, because the micro spray system just wouldn't get all the way down to the bottom of that large container. But a livestock trough worked very, very well for me.
One of the things that my friends used to do when we still had our old water supply, is that they worked in Sacramento, which had really nice, soft, you know, water and water.
Sacramento River water, yeah.
And so they would go and they would bring home containers of Sacramento water to water their blueberry bushes.
I ran into that.
It's really hard to make those blueberry bushes do well. And I'm glad we don't have to do that as much anymore. But I'm wondering if maybe where Ben is, if the water is really hard, do you have a source nearby that you can get some other water?
That's what people did here for rhododendrons and azaleas and blueberries and things like that. If they were commuting each day into Sacramento, they would fill a gallon jug with the tap water there. That's what we have now, folks. We now have Sacramento River water in Davis most of the time, about 80%+ of the time. So you don't have to do that anymore. It certainly wouldn't hurt to leach it through every now and then with water that isn't full of salts, but I'm not sure that's a real practical solution. Generally, the soil mix that's used has a lot of organic material and a lot of even bark in it. So I'm going to go ahead and give you a formula here. Many years ago, Ed Livo, who's with Dave Wilson Nursery and his frequent guest on Fred Hoffman's radio show and then podcast, came up with this recipe. And for those of you that like recipes, I know people who have used this and it works. So your blueberry soil recipe from Ed Livo and Fred Hoffman is 1/3 peat moss, 1/3 walk-on bark. That's just the finest bark. It's going to be called pathway bark, walk-on bark. Our nursery is called micro bark, fine particle bark, and one third, quote, acid soil mix. So that's a soil mix that's labeled for azaleas and rhododendrons and things like that. Honestly, citrus and palm planting mix would work just fine. So you have a mineral-based potting soil, you have bark, and you have peat moss, equal parts. You then take 2 cups of soil sulfur per plant and mix that into the soil around the roots. That is to say, mix it thoroughly, incorporate it into the soil. This is your only opportunity to do that, because in the future, you're going to put your soil sulfur on the surface where it works much more slowly. But in this case, you can mix it into the soil right around the roots. So 1 to 2 cups of soil sulfur, which you can buy at any garden center, any hardware store, mixed into the soil around the roots. Customer I know who did that and put them in a container that was not quite as big as a half barrel, but had at least 2 cubic feet of soil, ran a drip line so that each container, which had one blueberry plant in it, had a dripper coming up into it on a little tube, and there was a dripper right in there. And he and I chatted about this. He was an engineer. So I said, all right, so just all I need you to do is run that long enough that you see water coming out the bottom. So you know water is going all the way through. That took him, with his drip system, 6 minutes. 6 minutes with a drip system. Don't know what his output was, but probably 1/2 or 1 gallon per hour. Watered it enough to go all the way through. And he ran that every day for 6 minutes in this soil mix. And that worked great. He got more blueberries than he knew what to do with. So you can take this formula. You've got this recipe. You're going to give it plenty of water. If you do that, the soil you've used probably has enough fertilizer in it for the first full growing season. So in the future, all you're going to do, because the organic part is going to break down and the soil level will drop in these containers, you're just going to top them off each spring, each fall, whatever it takes, with 1, 2, 3 inches of mostly the organic soil. And hopefully that'll have nutrients in it, and that'll probably take care of the fertilizing that you need. That's a good time to sprinkle on another 1/2 cup to 1 cup of soil sulfur if you want to do that. We're finding the sulfur probably doesn't make that much difference. It's mostly the organic content of the soil, the mulching, and the real even moisture that leads to success. But if you want to use this formula, there we go. Equal parts peat moss, micro bark, small bark, and acid soil mix or citrus and palm type planting mix.
Do blueberries have particularly fragile roots? I would be concerned about trying to dig something into an already existing plant.
They do. They have a real fine network root system. When I've taken them out of containers afterwards, this is not like a, you know, a big woody plant like a rose where you have large roots that are substantial. They do have quite a network of fine roots, and they're easy to burn. My theory over the years is that a lot of the plants that we thought needed special soil pH and conditioners like that are actually, one, just sensitive to salts, which causes them to burn really easily, and two, because of their fine network of roots, not tolerant of drought at all. You think about plants, most of the plants you can think of in this category, you know where blueberries come from. They're places where they get 2 feet of maple leaves around them every fall. They get, you know,
and they're under the they're in cool places.
Cooler than here for sure, and higher humidity than here for sure. And also a good layer of organic mulch applied annually at 1 to 2 feet of it and breaking down steadily through the winter. And there's a lot of plants that really benefit from that. So you think about where a plant like that comes from and you try to replicate that to the greatest extent possible. The blueberries that we used to sell 40 years ago were not very tolerant of a wide range of conditions. Northern low bush blueberries are just not grown outside of northern states. Rabbit eye blueberries were grown in the southeastern United States. These southern high bush that have come on the market, and there's been more breeding on blueberries in the last 30 years than in the entire previous history of the plant. All these new varieties coming on the market, the home garden trend of dwarfer fruiting plants is, well, what a perfect choice for that. You have blueberry varieties that only get 2 to 3 feet and produce heavily. You have others that are 5 to 6 feet, make really lovely landscape and garden plants. I do not put them in full afternoon sun here, but I did plant my blueberries in pretty much full sun. I did a test years ago where I took a 6 plants and I had them grading from full all day sun. That was tough. To full sun into about 2 PM, which turned out to be perfect, to mostly shade where they grew nice, flowered, and didn't fruit all that well. So they do need sun to fruit well, but they don't look good here in the Sacramento Valley, or likely in the San Fernando Valley, during heat episodes when it's 3 or 4 PM and it's 100 degrees. So shading after early to mid-afternoon, I think, probably would make the plants do better. They fruited fine in both full sun and partial sun. They didn't fruit as well in more shade. So that's been my experience here.
Well, we have messages, lots of messages. And if you would like to have your message added to our list, please write to
DavisGardenShow@gmail.com.
All right. So Charlie writes, hi, Don and Lois. Fred and Ed talked about Fred and Ed. Don, who's Fred and Ed?
Fred Hoffman and Ed Livo. Fred Hoffman was a longtime radio garden host in Sacramento of the KFBK Garden Show and KSTE Garden Show, and has his own podcast over there at Get Growing with Farmer Fred.
Well, this is called Beyond Garden Basics.
That's his
And so
podcast,
they
yeah.
talked about this situation on their show. And the situation is that there's a peach tree that came up from seed in somebody's planter, and they didn't want it. So Charlie took it and he dug it up and he showed us a picture of the roots, which are all kind of gnarly, not a lot of root onto
Right.
it. And then he cut it down and put it in a pot, and has it has I see the picture shows the stem with a little tiny
Yeah.
bit of green coming out of it. So it is growing. So Fred and Ed said this was really not worth it. A peach tree from seed, so you don't know what it's going to be. It has a small root system. I had to dig it out of the raised bed, and it looks like it will make it. I did what Ed says to do, cut it to your knee height. I'm going to wait until early fall to plant it in the ground, or maybe plant it sooner. The roots seem to be growing, and you can see two little leaves coming out. I
Yeah.
like this challenge. And he then sent an addendum later. He said, I forgot to say the peach seed was from a supermarket peach.
Yeah,
I am
okay.
taking the challenge on. One more question. Okay, then, and that's another question later. Okay,
First
so
question
Don.
about his garlic. Okay, so whenever someone asks me if you can grow a fruit tree from seed, well, the most common answer you're going to get from plant experts is no, don't do that. Well, of course you can. You can grow a peach
You
tree from seed.
can. You
You
may not
can.
like it.
The question is whether the fruit will be any good. It will still be a peach. It'll be edible. It's not going to be awful. It's not, I have two or three on my property that came up in places where I was just fine with leaving them. One of them turned out to be a white peach with a pretty firm texture, and it's okay. If I were giving it on a scale of 1 to 10, it might get a 6. We like it. We ha harvest a few. It's not hurting anything, and we're not limited for space. So that would be the key question. Would you put all this effort into a peach tree from seed if you only had room for one peach tree in your backyard? No, because you'd want to make sure you're getting a good peach. Good news with peaches. 1 to 2 years in the ground, you'll have at least one or two fruit typically that you can sample to see whether it's been worth all of this fuss, because they will fruit on new wood. What grows this year fruits next year. So it's pretty easy to figure out within a couple of years of planting it out in the ground whether this is worth all of this effort. They could be fine. I mean, this is where new varieties do come from initially. When they come up with a new variety, they're hybridizing intentionally and they take the seedlings and they grow them out. And then they sample the fruit from the 100 seedlings they planted and they throw out 98 of them. And two of them have good enough fruit to continue testing or perhaps even take to market. Generally speaking, you don't get great results, but they're not bad. They're not inedible. So I wouldn't personally discourage you from growing it. I just want you to keep your expectations reasonable. Same thing with almost any fruit that you grow from seed. It's very rare for them to, quote, come true, as we say, from seed. And again, the good news with the peaches, you'll know pretty quickly. It takes 2 years to find out whether this has been worth all this trouble. It'll still grow fine. It's still a peach from a supermarket peach. Might even come pretty close to the parent because a supermarket peach was grown in an orchard where there's very, very little likelihood of cross-pollination. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if it's reasonably close to the parent, but I wouldn't promise that. That's the only point I guess it's being made, is this could be a lot of effort for something that turns out not to be outstanding.
You said if 2 years after it's put in the ground, you'd get some fruit and you could see whether or not it was any good.
Probably, yeah.
Would you keep the peach in a pot for 2 years until it fruited, or would it
Well,
not fruit?
Charlie's in Brooklyn where that would be possible. In this climate, keeping a peach in a 5 gallon container for 2 years would be a lot of watering. You would need water every single day. In a wetter climate, by the way, I'm really sorry about your weather this week, Charlie. My daughter lives there and it's going to be 100 degrees tomorrow in Brooklyn with
And raining.
a chance of rain. Yeah, so that's pretty awful. But the good news is you guys can grow things in containers a lot longer than we can. So you could try it that way. If I were going to do that, I'd probably shift it maybe next winter or early spring from a 5 gallon up to a 15 gallon, let it grow that way and see how you like the fruit. Or just stick it in the ground someplace where it won't be hard to take out in a couple of years. Very good chance it'll have a peach that's okay. The problem is that won't be a peach that's outstanding, but you got it going. The root system appears to have survived. There's growth buds coming on the stem. So I think you have a plant, and whether or not you have good fruit, time will tell.
Okay. And Charlie wrote back with a little clarification. And then he added this question. What is happening to my garlic? There are only two that look like this. I'm going to harvest the garlic this week or next week. And the picture that he sent has what it looks to me like is it has a leaf that, or a stalk, probably a flower stalk that tried to come out and it didn't quite, the tip didn't quite make it out of the plant as it was coming. Is that what you're seeing, Don?
Yeah, it's a flower escape, as they call them, and it was pushing out, and something happened that made it so it couldn't quite push out fully. So you could, free that and let it push out and be a flower. We don't grow garlic for the flowers, so this isn't particularly an issue. And my guess is the bulbs themselves will probably be fine. That is what happened. Yes, probably some strange fluctuation in the weather or high moisture caused the scape to get trapped or blocked as it was pushing out to expand. And so it just got stuck there. So it's just a physiological phenomenon. It's not going to harm the plant and not going to hurt your garlic.
And since you don't want the flower stalk, if you don't want the flower stalk, wouldn't you just cut that off? Because the bulbs aren't going to care, are they?
The bulbs do not care. Some people eat the flower scapes. They're considered tasty and gourmet-ish. And so you can certainly use that. It tastes like mild garlic. You could certainly use it that way. So nothing wrong with it. It just was a weird physiological phenomenon, almost entirely, almost certainly related to the weather.
Okay. So, next question. All right. This is, we're getting holes in the leaves. We've been spraying with neem and soap and it isn't working.
The holes in the leaves in your garden are more commonly caused by a chewing organism, not necessarily an insect, snails and slugs being mollusks. Earwigs can feed on leaves, caterpillars, katydids, grasshoppers, all of these. So, spraying with neem, this is just beginning to drive me crazy. Without knowing what you were spraying for, probably wasn't very effective. And indeed, it says here, but it isn't working. Well, that's probably because whatever made the holes in the leaves has moved on or been eaten by birds or something. So, I generally look at the damage. It's really helpful to have a leaf with a hole in it or a picture of it and look at where on the leaf it is. Is it in the center of the leaf or is it starting only from the edge? That tells me something about the size of the organism that did it. I look at whether it's clean, discrete, or kind of shredded. That's shredded is more likely larger caterpillar, snail, and slug. They're kind of sloppy eaters. Or is it just like a random hole here? And a foot away on the same plant, another random hole. That's almost surely grasshopper or katydid, which feed locally and then move on. So, as with everything, before you even reach for a spray, before you even think about using a pesticide, you need to know what the pest is. So, you don't do ready, fire, aim, which is what they did. You do ready, aim, fire. You need to know what you're shooting. So, you
Or
don't.
ready, aim, hold your fire.
Yes, in many cases, the simplest answer is monitor. You've got a couple holes in the leaf. Okay, go out the next day. Are there more? Less? The same? If it's not increasing, then it was just something fairly transient, like a grasshopper or katydid that came through and did some localized damage and moved on. When you find them out there, you can just flick them off or kill them if you're inclined. But generally speaking, their damage is very limited. It's just a hole here, a hole there, maybe a fair bit of it in one spot. And then they move along and they get eaten by birds or they go off and multiply themselves. They don't do enough damage for you to be concerned about it. If damage is repeating and increasing in the same spot, and you're not finding the pest itself, it's probably snails, slugs, or earwigs, in which case you need to be going out at night to monitor or put some traps out. In the case of snails and slugs, you're familiar with beer traps. In the case of earwigs, you can use cooking oil, which will attract them in much the same way. Those tend to be very seasonal here. In the Sacramento Valley, one of the things I loved about moving here compared to coastal San Diego was that snails were suddenly just a seasonal thing, not a year-round thing. Because when it gets dry, get low humidity, dew point is low, they just can't get out as well. And they essentially go into a sort of a summer dormancy. So they're more of a spring and beginning of the rainy season problem, not a midsummer problem. Earwigs tend to be very much late April through May, and then they're done. They're dispersing now, going off to find places to make their dens. So you find them in your garage or coming into the house, but you don't find as many of them out in the garden typically. If it's a little bit of damage, and then there's more the next day, then there's a whole bunch of damage. Well, I would turn the leaf over. You'll probably find caterpillars, because caterpillars typically will feed very aggressively for a fairly short period of time. You've probably read that really riveting book, The Very Hungry Caterpillar, which the entire plot is how much it eats. Well, yep, if you're a gardener, you know all about that. You can go from a little bit of damage in between the veins and a few of the leaves are essentially skeletonized to all of a sudden a whole bunch of leaves gone or being significantly damaged. You'll typically find the caterpillars present. So usually that one's a pretty easy one to identify. Commonly, there are red hump caterpillars. Sometimes there's others in this area. If they're doing enough damage that you're concerned about the plant, there's this nice, safe organic spray for caterpillars that's been on the market for years. Any of the BT products will work. I've noticed on my own property, when things like the red hump caterpillar hatch out and start to do a lot of damage, the way I know it's happening, our old friends, the jay mockingbirds, are down there making all kinds of noise. And I'll go down, wow, you guys are taking care of this problem for me. Thank you very much. Again, working hard on our behalf. I appreciate it very much. Go enjoy some mulberries when you're done.
So, and put out a little water for the birds. They appreciate that in our hot summer days.
Yeah, actually, they love it when you have some sort of like a shallow water thing out. Mockingbirds and jays both enjoy that a great deal. They become rather territorial about it. So identify the problem. The holes give you a guide. To some degree, they tell you big mouth parts, little mouth parts, same spot over and over, something coming back and doing it again and again, random, probably already gone, don't worry about it. And again, at night with a flashlight, I know it sounds like a weird thing to keep telling you to do, but that'll answer a lot of your questions, especially in late spring, if you're having problems going out with a flashlight and realizing, oh, there's a lot of holes in this marigold plant because there's 14 earwigs on a single plant. Then you know what you need to deal with. And we can talk about that. Neem wouldn't do anything for that. It's not going to kill earwigs, nor snails, nor caterpillars for the most part. So spraying first without knowing what you're dealing with is not a good plan. Monitoring is very important. Most cases, these problems do tend to solve themselves, has been my experience.
Okay, I have a question, and that is neem. Now, neem's an oil. I understand that. And so it would cover the surface of the plant. I assume the theory is that it would smother whatever was under it.
Yeah.
But isn't it going to also damage the plant?
It can. That's our
in our covers the plant.
In our climate, it can. It's sold in oil form most commonly, and yes, most oils simply smother aphids, whiteflies, things like that. That's what they're primarily used for. So using neem for a chewing insect to me wouldn't be the starting point. If you're going to do a spray, you want to be organic, and you've got a chewing insect, you're probably going to use spinosad. Read the label carefully, but that's a different thing. Neem does smother the insect. It also has an odor and is said to be repellent. And I would agree it is repellent. It's not awful.
It's repellent to people, but is it
somewhat? Somewhat. We used it in our nursery when it first came on the market, and we found this wasn't something we wanted to do in retail. Even though it's very safe, we didn't want that odor there. It does seem to repel the winged aphids as they're coming in to land. I've watched this way back when we used it on roses and things. They would come in to land, and then they would be on the smell would be there, and they'd just go back up and they'd move, you know, fly on to the next plant. So it does seem to have some repellent properties, but it's an oil. And like horticultural oils, above about 85 degrees, a film of oil on the plant leaf can cause leaf burn. So you get phytotoxicity. So you've fried your plant in order to kill a pest that you haven't yet identified. I don't recommend using oils here in the valley really anytime after about mid to late May, and neem is usually in oil form. So it's not the first thing I would go to by any stretch. And in most cases, it is just not necessary, nor will it be effective for a chewing insect.
Well, if we're going to talk about holes, I want to talk about the holes that I like on plants. And it's only on certain plants. The thing I've seen mostly is on the a redbud. And the leaves of redbud are lovely, round, beautiful, and they're kind of thin.
Yep.
And there is something called a leaf cutter bee, which comes to some thin leaf plant.
Certain plants, yeah.
Redbud, and will start on the edge and it will cut out a circle and then carry that away to go put it in a nest. And they'll come back to the same leaf.
Yeah, same leaf.
Yeah. And it'll do another circle. And so you'll eventually, if in the springtime, you might see a redbud that has a leaf with these little circles around the edges. And then you know you got that leaf cutter bee.
It looks like someone
now,
took
it. It isn't every plant.
No.
It isn't even in the redbud. Every red, you can have a row of redbud. I've seen this in Don's place.
Yeah.
A row of redbuds for sale, and one of them gets holes in the leaves.
Yeah, so we leave it there because we want to leave it and let the same leaf cutter bee keep coming back to that one rather than moving on to something else. It's like our sacrificial redbud. In particular, they like redbud, lilac. I've seen them do this to gardenias, but in wisteria, they typically, and roses, they like a thin leaf. I was a little surprised by the gardenia, but the other things are all thin leafed, relatively thin coating on the leaf, so they can get on there and basically saw out a piece. It looks like they took a paper punch to the leaf. So perfect, yeah. And they take them back. We've watched them. They fly back to the siding on our building, and they go into a nail hole there, and they the same one going in there over and over again. They're lining their nest with it. It's an introduced bee, was introduced to pollinate alfalfa. We also have native leaf cutter bees, but this one is far more common as the introduced one. It's a beneficial insect. It's basically not hurting the plant. There's nothing practical to be done about it. I had a customer who they was doing it to their gardenia so much they wanted to do something, and I said, okay, we'll just cover the plant. This only goes on for a few weeks, so just drape it with something, and you know, like frost blanket, and that'll probably solve the problem at least temporarily. But they are beneficial, so we don't really go out of our way. But yes, that's a very distinct pattern. It's fun to explain to people. You've probably never seen this bee because you don't really know what you're looking for, but it's about a half to two-thirds the size of a honeybee and doesn't have the same distinctive markings. And they're not aggressive at all, and they're basically solitary. So we find them going into bamboo stakes in pots. We find them going into the siding on the building where there was a nail hole, that kind of thing. And they don't really do any harm. They're beneficial, so again, don't worry about them.
So, Don, we got a question from someone who said, I went to your website, meaning his commercial website, mm-hmm. to look up bamboo, and it was a lot of stuff, pretty overwhelming.
Yeah.
Maybe you could just say, what is the best bamboo for the Davis area?
Bambusa multiplex is the group.
There you get an answer.
And that's then wonderful. within that, there's Golden Goddess, there's Alphonse Carr, there's Eddie Goodell. Those are three very good ones that stay small enough to fit in a normal yard. If you have room for a big bamboo, the Weaver's bamboo, Bambusa textilis, I think is one of the most beautiful of the large bamboos. And these are all clump forming types. My plant of Alphonse Carr that is 30 years old is 6 feet across at the base. So it's a big shrub, but that's what it's done in 30 years. A running bamboo in 30 years, I would have about half an acre. So these are types that you can fit in a normal yard, and they do very well in this area and anywhere in the interior of California.
Okay. Now I have an article that Don has forwarded to me. I'll just read part of the first paragraph and then you can summarize the rest of it. California's cherry industry entered the 2026 season with optimism, ideal growing conditions, and expectations for one of the best crops in recent years. Instead, growers, packers, shippers, retailers, and consumers endured what veteran industry leader calls the most difficult cherry season of his 38-year career.
Yeah.
What happened?
It rained. And this is something, the only reason I bring this up is that some of you are still growing sweet cherries. I know this spotted wing Drosophila, the fruit fly, has caused most people to stop growing them. But we had, as they say here in this article, a major rain event on April 21st. Followed by additional storms over the next 2 to 3 weeks. We've noticed that here, that we had late season disease problems. With cherries, the varieties that are grown here in the Sacramento Valley and especially around the Stockton area, interior of the Delta, they choose them because they ripen early. They get a really premium price for early burlap and some of the other varieties that they grow down there. And that means they're selling them for the Memorial Day weekend. They're getting twice the price per pound that they would get a month later. Rain, it floods into the plant or is taken up by the plant. If it's already expanded the fruit and has the waxy coating that protects the fruit bursts, it splits. And fruit splitting is a huge problem on Bing, which is the classic red cherry, early burlap, Brooks, a lot of the other varieties that they're growing in the cherry industry. The fruit was so badly damaged that half the crop was roughly destroyed. Actually, some growers lost 63.5% of their crop in the San Joaquin County area, which is about $174 million market loss. And that was just one growing district. The cherries are an important crop in the San Joaquin Valley, southern part of the Sacramento Valley, and this late season weather wiped them out. So they had a really rough year last year for a bunch of reasons. Insufficient winter chilling last year, reduced production. They went into the season with great hopes, and then rain caused them to have to delay their harvest. They got wind damage. We had hailstorms, and the crop was off by about half. So if you are a home gardener and you had a cherry tree, pretty good chance if you have Bing, which is a very popular home garden variety, that you had this problem. If you're looking to buy a cherry tree, we could have other conversations about reasons a lot of people have gone away from cherry trees, but I would say don't plant Bing, plant Van. Van is just like Bing in terms of fruit quality, but is much less susceptible to fruit splitting. So as a home gardener, you have an option for something that would have gotten you past this problem. Commercially, they're looking at the early ripening and the good quality in the month of May, and that has very high value. Farming is a gamble, and boy, they gambled and lost this year with that late season rainfall. We are going to see effects from that late season rainfall that continued even into May with grapes and certain other crops. Someone sent me a picture of mildew on a nectarine. It looked like powdery mildew. It looked like mold on a nectarine. Yeah, that's late season rainfall caused to that. A bunch rot and downy mildew on grapes will be a problem because it infected in that late season rainfall we had second or third week of May. So we're going to see those. And there's nothing you as a home gardener can really do except one thing. In the case of grapes, get out there and thin the plant. Get better air circulation in there. Even thin the clusters. If they're hanging to the point of touching, take some of them out so they're not touching the clusters themselves. Get some of the foliage out of there so you get better air circulation, better sunlight in there. You could diminish the problem, especially if we get into fairly normal weather patterns. Otherwise, a fair bit of the fruit, as we get into late July and early August, will start to rot right in the cluster, which is frustrating. If that is happening as it's ripening, you can still use them. You can still get in there and take the cluster and get rid of the bad ones really quickly. If you let it hang on the vine into mid-August, which would be a typical harvest season for a lot of table grapes, they'll probably spoil. So get better air circulation, thin the clusters if you can, keep an eye on it, and you know, just be aware that this is an impact from late season rainfall.
So given that we are so dry in the summer, would hosing off the grapes help? Any of that stuff out?
It would wash off the powdery mildew, which you could get on the foliage, but it would actually perhaps exacerbate the bunch rot and the cluster issues. So I would be concerned
even
about that.
It
traps moisture in. Those grapes are so tight together that you're trapping moisture there. So this is one case where if you're going to do that, do it early in the day. Do it on a day when the north wind is blowing or when it's very low humidity. But the thinning of the vines is something that's done commercially. The wine grape growers thin them out to get better airflow and to color up their grapes better. But also they do remove some clusters to get better quality. And that's something that you can do. I know home gardeners hate to do this. Fruit thinning, what you do on your stone fruits and your other fruits, does also apply to grape vines.
Well, Don sometimes sends me pictures, and this time he sent a picture, and at first glance, I thought, oh, morning glory, but then I look closer, and it's got too many petals, or too few. It's kind of hard to tell. It looks like there are 10 petals all fused together, so it's a circle. It's like a circle skirt with gores in it. And then out of the middle comes a stigma. Is that the right word, Don?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And all the little yellow fluffy bits and stuff. So I looked at that and I'm thinking, well, I think morning glories don't have that inflorescence. And so I'm looking at it some more. It looks to me in the picture like it's hanging down. But it turns out if you look closer, this is a picture from the top.
Yeah.
And it's looking down a plant. And once Don said what it was, I went, oh, of course it's 4 o'clock.
4 o'clock.
If it had
the color break, that is one of the things that makes 4 o'clock very popular, you would have probably known it right away. Because 4 o'clock, very commonly, the seed strains that are sold have been selected because they'll pop a different color in the part of a petal. So you get this really interesting, and we call them color breaks. It's almost like a variegated flower. So that's one of the things that makes 4 o'clock popular. They're very, very popular with afternoon and evening flying moths, sphinx moths, and others. They love the 4 o'clocks because they open at 4 o'clock late afternoon. They're fragrant into the evening. They have a wonderful sweet scent. They close, they're open through the night into the morning. I took this picture early in the morning, and then they're closed up now. 4 o'clocks are, shall we say, very easy to grow.
I'm laughing because this thing reseeds, spreads. I mean, I remember one alley in Davis, and I had seen one little plant of that, and then I came back a few years later and the entire alley was covered with this stuff. Yeah. It's like, yeah, it spreads.
Yes, the morning glory being another example. 4 o'clock, borage, larkspur, these are nigella, the Persian jewels. These are plants that you only need to plant once. I will say the 4 o'clocks have one added factor. It's not just that they reseed, they also form a tuber. And so that resprouts. So they're perennial and reseeding. And so, yeah, once you plant 4 o'clock, you'll tend to always have them. Great for rural properties or for those of you with informal flower borders where you have things that are just naturalizing themselves and you let them grow or not. Hollyhocks and 4 o'clocks and all those other things I mentioned all go very
it's
well.
It's good for people who don't have neighbors who are picky.
Yeah, right. So I'm looking out the window. I've got like 5 big plants of 4 o'clocks from a place where I put in one. 3 years ago. That's about right. That's about the usual rate of increase, 500% over 3 years. Be careful where you plant 4 o'clocks, but I figured that would be our featured plant right now. You're looking for something easy to grow, definitely in that category. And it does draw special pollinators. It draws the hawk moths or sphinx moths and lots of others. I've seen lots of things going to them. Hummingbirds absolutely love them. I don't know if they have a nectar reward or what, but they definitely go to these guys. So another easy plant to grow for those of you that prefer, again, informal flower borders.
Don, you know, we forgot to do that thing about, well, if you've got a rodent problem, you catch them at your house, you take them out in the country and you let them go. But I got to tell you, not only is that illegal, but rodents, their social life is such that they're territorial.
Yep.
And if you take one from where they are now in your yard and you take it to some other place and let it go, you just killed the thing. You've just done it slower because the rodents over there aren't going to let it stay.
Yeah, go ahead and tag it for me so I can catch it here out in the country and bring it back to you, because I'm not quite sure where out in the country you think you're going to take these. It's going to be okay. It's an invasive vermin that probably has diseases. So this is more the point. It's illegal. To catch something in a live trap, there's only two things you can do. You can release it on your own property right away, or you can euthanize it humanely. That's it. You can use a snap trap. Please do not use baits. Vertebrate pests is a term we use for furry or feathered plant eaters, and they can be very frustrating. I understand both squirrels and roof rats are problems locally, and squirrels have increased over the last couple of decades after having arrived here in the 1990s. So for any pest, our question is, what is the animal's adaptive strategy? Why is it so difficult for us to control it? And what is the least harmful method we can use to manage it? Well, the adaptive strategy of rats and squirrels is fecundity. Lots of babies, multiple generations each season, and multiple nesting sites. If you have a lot of them in your neighborhood, it means they have a big nest somewhere, but they also are probably making satellite nests in your yard, your neighbor's yard, on top of that shed you have in the back, in that little tree over there where it's a little overgrown. Those are secondary nesting sites. I've watched this on my property, and they'll move their young there if they have to, or they'll just use them as a base of operations before heading back to their big old nest that's maybe in the neighbor's yard. So they also have a wide range of food preferences and very little fear of humans. What they are afraid of is things flying over them. They're very adapted to an urban environment because there's lots of overhead protection in an urban environment. Overhangs from the roof, trees, things like that, overgrown yards. There is little point in trying to kill them. Each female produces several young at a time. Gestation is just a few weeks, and they have multiple litters each year. How many do you think you could kill to put a dent in the population? You probably couldn't do it. They basically exist to forage, feed, and mate. No matter how many you kill, they'll be replaced in no time. So don't really bother trying to reduce the population directly. When I took courses in range management and wildlife biology, they both referred to carrying capacity. If your neighborhood has a big problem with them, it's because your neighborhood has a high carrying capacity, lots of habitat, lots of food sources. So don't feed squirrels. You feed squirrels, you're also feeding rats almost for sure. Remember that their weak point is they need cover. They don't want to even run across a fence open to the sky, or they want to move as fast as they can. They don't like to be exposed to predators, especially at night in the case of the tree rats, during the daytime in the case of the squirrels. You'll watch them scamper from shrub to tree to hiding place on the fence, and then they jump into your citrus tree where they feel very safe. They can spend half an hour eating an orange or something like that. So pruning things away from each other, cleaning up piles of debris, making it harder for them to run across the fence line, and clearing out the areas where they might be nesting in your property, and avoiding any food sources, having, say, cat food outside, things like that. Don't do that. Just make sure that's all inside in a sheltered location. And don't feed squirrels. Yes, I know they're cute. Please don't feed them. If your neighborhood has large populations of vertebrate pests and you can't control them, you might want to consider enclosing the garden, as we've discussed on the show. We've even had listeners send in pictures of techniques that they've used to make physical barriers. Those do work because you're simply keeping them out by exclusion. Yes, of course, they could crawl under or chew through or something if they really wanted to, but they want to keep moving. So if you put that kind of barrier over, as I like to joke, you're trying to make it easier for them to feed in your neighbor's yard than in your yard. You want to have them move on from your garden to someplace where they feel safe and protected. You're not going to try and kill them. You're not going to try and control the population. You're just trying to prevent the damage.
Okay, I wanted to mention to any of you who are planning to go away on vacation and have hummingbird feeders, I'm going to give you the results of our experiment. Okay. We have hummingbird feeders. We have four around the house, two in the back that just kept getting
decimated
amazingly fast, and Jim would have to fill them up twice a day. So we were going to be gone for a week, and I thought, okay, so if I leave them out there, they'll get empty and the hummingbirds will come and there'll be nothing to, you know, but it'll be there. So I took down those two. I left the others that weren't used as much. I took down those two, took them away so that during the week we were gone, there was nothing there. And my thought process was that when they see them, when they're back, they'll come and they'll get something and it won't, they won't have given up on that particular perpetual flower. It worked.
Oh, it did. Okay. So they weren't lined up on the fence, grumping at you when you walked in the backyard.
No. It took about 2 days for them to be refound. Mm-hmm. And in the last couple of days, okay, we've been back for a week. They're back.
So take them down. When you're going away, take them down, wash them out real thoroughly, set them aside, put them back up as soon as you get back. They'll figure it out.
They'll figure it out. Because think about it. Flowers come and go. They have their seasons. Yeah, why not? Okay. I wanted to do our garden quote today a little different than usual. And this is a quote from a cartoon, Pickles. I don't know if you know the Pickles cartoon. Yeah. And he's standing there with the hose, watering the lawn. And he goes, Dallin Oaks said, "We are all a work in progress, so we need to be patient with each other." And then it cuts to his wife, who's over there with the hoe, going, "Come on, you stupid zucchinis, let's get growing." And he says, "I believe that patience applies to vegetable gardens too."
Gardening teaches us patience. There we go. That's our.
And it's 6/27 is the date on this if you want to go see the original.
Okay. Learn patience by gardening. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.